And our text today, our preaching text, is Acts 16, 25 to 34. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in his house, and he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds. And he was baptized at once, he and all his family. Then he brought them up into his house and set food before them, and he rejoiced along with his entire household that he had believed in God. Horacio Morales is an immigrant from Mexico that Deb and I know from local farmers markets in Teton Valley and in Jackson, Wyoming. Horacio, what a great name, isn't that a good strong name? Horacio and his family have been in America for over 15 years. And they're a great, sweet family. Some of you who've visited us at the markets have met them. They are kind and generous to all they meet. And they've been an anchor market vendor. That's an anchor vendor is a reliable, consistent, dependable vendor. And they've been such ever since we've known them. Mama Morales Tamales. If you come out to visit us, you have to get some of Mama Morales' tamales. One of the things that everyone loves about them is that they did immigration right. In the beginning, they obtained work visas for the summer and then returned to Mexico in the fall. They applied for citizenship. They navigated all the bureaucracy and red tape that involves. They attended citizenship classes and insisted that everyone learn English. 4 years ago, they became U.S. citizens, and some of us had a mini party for them after market season. In my many conversations with Horacio and his oldest son, Juan, I asked them if it was difficult bringing his whole family with him over all of these years. So many immigrants, legal and illegal, will enter the U.S. individually, establish themselves, and either send money back home or bring families in piecemeal over the years. But Horacio looked at me with a tear in his eye, and he said solemnly, "I could never do that. Some of my people do because they feel there is no other choice. I do not look at it that way. Next to God, my family is the most important thing. Every year, we bring the whole house. My mother and father, my wife, my children. It's sometimes difficult and it's expensive, but in the end, it is all worthwhile. My whole house is here." The Philippian jailer must have said something of the same thing when Paul told him what he must do to be saved. "Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your household." And he was baptized at once, he and all his family. Unnecessary controversy has surrounded this idea of household over the years. I say unnecessary because it is well grounded in good scholarship. Just as Horatio could not think of coming without his whole house to the land of milk and honey, so the Philippian jailer could not think of coming to Christ in baptism without his whole house. Let's examine our text today and see how this is borne out, shall we? 2 points I want to make with you today from our text. Point number one, household. When the definition of household is considered, salvation is promised to adults youths and infants. Now, our purpose here today is not to detail the story of the Philippian jailer and the circumstances of Paul and Silas. Rather, we want to focus on the direct aftermath of God's miraculous deliverance of Paul and Silas as it affected the jailer. Note what Paul exclaims right away. Sirs, what must I do to be saved? Wait a minute. Wasn't Paul, was it? It was a deer. We might expect, however, from the normal circumstances that Paul might have exclaimed this. We could see him doing that. It's the prisoner who needs saving, isn't it? We would expect Paul to appeal to the jailer for salvation from his captivity. But that's not what's been happening, has it? It is the jailer, then, who has just witnessed the power of God in delivering Christ's faithful servants. Paul and Silas, in freeing them from the power of their persecutors, God has done by springing the doors of the jail with a supernatural earthquake. In effect, God put his stamp of approval upon Paul and Silas and their message by freeing them from the bowels of a hellish prison, a captivity far worse than anything suggested by Guantanamo Bay or the D.C. Gulag, where the January 6 prisoners languish. All through Philippi, a spiritual bondage, a spiritual captivity, had been abundantly evident. Paul and Silas have just freed a slave girl possessed by a spirit of divination. Paul and Silas have preached Jesus as a liberator from the superstitious customs of Rome, notorious for their paganism. This was a Roman colony, after all. How ironic that they had been thrown into a physical prison of stone and iron, buried deep within the bowels of the earth, when the jailer and the slave girl and the crowds were bound in a spiritual prison of superstition and darkness. Roman culture was fast disintegrating with a number of trends. Sexual and marital debauchery was rampant throughout the Roman Empire. Divorce, adultery, homosexuality, venereal disease characterized the lifestyle of the hip and progressive Roman. Poets like Juvenal lamented and lampooned the alcohol and the drug addiction that afflicted the lower classes of Roman society in particular. Despair, suicide, hopelessness gripped the people such that even the emperor Nero, who was no lover of the Roman people, said, "Either the empire must die or I must die, but despair will be the sword that kills one or the other of us." Nero was a drama queen, really, in the end. But what he exclaimed was true. Well, into this abject world of darkness and despair, so unlike our own, right? Well, came the gospel of light and hope. And note the hope, light, and life in this prison, despite the despair, darkness, and death. William Barclay says, "The one thing you can never take away from a Christian is God and the presence of Jesus Christ. With God there is freedom, even in a prison, and even at midnight there is light." This light and life and hope can be yours, too, if you do not know it. It sounds appealing, it's true, and it's strong. It's not too late. Our jailer proves this with his actual question, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" He realized the difference starkly between what he had known before as a lost and despairing jailer, a keeper of other men's death and despair. Someone has said that. A jailer is but a keeper of other men's death and despair. In my first call in Illinois, I counseled a young man who had done time in a state penitentiary, and he told me how the prisoners would taunt the guards, "You're doing time in this hellhole too, 8 hours a day. You're just on that side of the bars," right? There's something to that. What the jailer knew now, however, after having observed firsthand the liberating effect of the gospel of Jesus Christ upon the heart and the mind of the truly converted, he was able to exclaim, "What must I do to be saved?" And it's essential to observe the answer of Paul, too. Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved. Note the consistent message we see throughout the Bible. The jailer is told to believe. Not climb a tall mountain, or cross a wide ocean, or slay a dragon, or live a life of good works. No, he is told to place his faith, to believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved. It's not your good works or good life that saves you, but your faith in the work of Jesus on your behalf. In fact, if you do rely on your good works, you will surely die. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2, "By grace you have been saved through faith, and this not of yourselves, but it is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one can boast." So observe also to whom salvation is offered. To whom is salvation offered here? Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. You and just you by the skin of your teeth. Now that's my unauthorized version again. It's not the 20th century evangelical version of the gospel where only someone who makes a personal profession of faith is offered salvation. This is to the jailer and his household. What could the Apostle Paul possibly mean when he assured the Philippian jailer in all confidence that salvation was not only being offered to him, but his household? Let's look at the Greek word that's used. You're all right, Greek students. The word is oikos, omicron, iota, kappa, omicron, sigma. Okay, you got that? Household. This is a word used often in the New Testament, oikos. Oikos, household. What a beautiful word. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, "I did baptize also the household of Stephanas." Lydia was baptized, we read in our New Testament reading, baptized with her household. Or in Acts chapter 18, Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with all his household. Oikos. Well then, who is included in the idea of oikos, the household, huh? Well, first is the evidence from the Old Testament. That is from the Septuagint, of course, which was the Hebrew Old Testament translated into Greek for those in the diaspora. From 1 Samuel 22:16, Saul orders Doeg the Edomite to kill Ahimelech and all his household, both man and woman, child and infant. Included here in the household, child and infant. Genesis 45 and 18, Pharaoh ordered Joseph to take your father and your households, your little ones and your wives, and bring your father and come. Your little ones included in the household. And from 1 Samuel 1:21, another example, the text tells us that every year Elkanah went up with all his household to offer sacrifice, except for the infant Samuel, who was part of his household. And then from Genesis 17:23, here we see that Abraham took all those born in his household, that is everyone of male gender down to babies 8 days old, and had them circumcised. So, just four examples. There are many more from the Old Testament. Infants, children, included in the household by definition. In addition to the Old Testament and the New Testament passages just cited, there is the early use of the New Testament word oikos in other documents. For example, the church father Ignatius in his letter to the Smyrnians said, "Greetings to the father and mother of the household, which includes the children of every age." And in his magisterial study of the word oikos, I highly recommend, if you're ever in doubt about this, check out Joachim Jeremias' book on this word oikos. He says, "When it comes to the rite of baptism, no single member of the household was excluded from baptism. The oikos formula not only referred to the children in addition to the adults, but had, and listen to this, quite special reference to the children. He has that in italics. The oikos formula had quite special reference to the children, and not least to any small children who might be present, unquote. So we see that if we're going to be honest with the word oikos, household, we must see this as not an argument from silence, but an argument that would have shouted loudly to his first century audience that you will be saved, you and your household. Paul's sermon to the Philippian jailer would have been consistent with Peter's sermon to the Pentecost Jews. The promise is for you and for your children. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that every child was saved automatically, as if just being born into a Christian family guaranteed that one was a covenant child. This would be to make the same mistake as the wayward Jews of the Old Testament, that just because one was born a Jew and circumcised, that he was automatically saved. Rather, Paul's reassurance to the Philippian jailer, you will be saved, you and your household, meant that insofar as the child made manifest all of the signs of being in the covenant and lived a loving and obedient life to Christ, every father could be assured that indeed his infant had grown up to be a redeemed, saved child of God. This is that very same promise to you, O Father. The promise was to him and to his children. The promise was that you will be saved, you and your household. What then was the obedient child of God to do with his household? His oikos. That brings us to point two. Verses 33 and 34. Household. When the definition of household is considered, and we've just done that as carefully as we can here within the time given us. When the definition of household is considered, baptism is applied to adults, youths, and infants. Our text presents us with two washings here. First of all, the jailer washes the wounds of Paul and Silas. Prior to their being thrown into prison, our text tells us that Paul and Silas had their garments torn off and their backs beaten with rods. Verse 23 documents that for us. And these bloody wounds, the jailer now tenderly, lovingly washes clean. And the other washing, of course, Paul and Silas wash the wounds of the jailer. Upon being released from the prison of sin and darkness, our Philippian jailer has the wounds of sin tenderly, lovingly washed away by the apostle in baptism. There's a deliberate parallel here, deliberately intended by Luke in Acts. Which do you think was the greater washing? Which do you think brought the greater relief and joy? Chrysostom, in his commentary on this passage, he says, he washed and was washed. He washed them from their stripes, and he himself was washed from his sins. How about you? How about you? We go on to see that it was not just the jailer himself who was baptized, but also his whole household, his oikos, which he further explains by calling it all his family. Now, many of our Credo Baptist friends, that is those who maintain that only upon a credible profession of faith should anyone be baptized, that because infants are not specifically mentioned, we cannot use this as a proof text for infant baptism. It is, to their minds at least, merely an argument from silence to use a text like this and others like it in the New Testament to prove our point. Yet there is perhaps more here than they might think. As we mentioned earlier, when this oikos formula is used both in the Old Testament and in the baptism formulas of the church fathers, it required children. Jeremiah, once again in his study, says the New Testament oikos formula was adopted from the Old Testament cultic language, and in particular, we may say, from the terminology of circumcision, and introduced the formal language employed in the primitive rite of baptism. It has the same form and the same meaning as the old biblical ritual formula. That is, it includes small children as well as others. Unquote. In fact, it would have been unusual for a family, a household, an oikos, not to have infants. There's not a case in the Fathers or in the Old Testament when it's used with a rite of circumcision, when household does not have children. So when our redeemed jailer baptizes his family, he also baptizes his infants. Even as a convert to Judaism would have circumcised his infant boys under the old covenant. It would have been unusual in the extreme for his family not to have had infants and children. Since this is the use of the term oikos, it required it, by definition required it. There's also another important point to make in this regard, that is, fathers made decisions on behalf of their families, to which every member of that family bore responsibility. Unlike our own extreme individualistic culture, scholars call this the idea of the corporate personality. The corporate personality, where the family acted in unity through the decisions and actions of the federal head, the father. This places a great burden on all of you fathers, because this is precisely the biblical model. Jeremiah puts it this way. He says, all important questions were decided by the father of the household, and his decision was binding on all, in particular in its relation to God. The household was a unity. And so, there is, in reality, a family solidarity. There is a family solidarity when it comes to religion and its observances. In utter contrast to our extreme individualism found in our own culture. Unfortunately, it is this extreme individualism that we bring to the issue of baptism. In biblical culture, when the father was converted, whether it was Stephanus or Crispus or our own Philippian jailer, the whole house was converted, every member of the family, and they were responsible for carrying out the duties and obligations of whatever covenant the father entered into. To look within and navel gaze and wonder, well, am I truly converted and born again, never entered the minds of wives, daughters, sons, and servants, as it does in our introspective individualistic culture. In any given family nowadays, parents magnanimously, piously say, oh, I'm going to let my kids choose for themselves whatever path they desire. No wonder they go off the rails. No wonder they go to hell, right? How foolish. Is there not an eternity looming? Is there not a wrath to come from which we must escape? There is a real heaven and a real hell, a mere breath away for every living soul. Can you imagine any father in the path of a volcano or a flood when there's only one way out of town saying to all of his wife and children, there's the door, dear ones, choose your own path to safety. No, that is an attitude of our witless, tolerant, diversity-obsessed culture, however. If a father is going to love his family and accept responsibility for his actions, he will wisely and judiciously choose the path to safety and lead his family with him, as Horacio Morales did with his family coming from Mexico. And so this is precisely what the Philippian jailer does as he follows the biblical path laid out for him in the preaching of the gospel. For the ancient observer, whether you experienced a genuine new birth or got born again was an issue pressed upon you in the preaching of the gospel. They spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in his house, right? And you better had, because you were getting baptized and God would ever after look upon you as a covenant child and expect the kinds of signs of life demonstrated by a child of his, right? Truly born from above. If you're here baptized today, you are marked. God expects the fruits and evidences of a covenant child from you because you are marked so. The point is, just as the priest in the Old Testament would not wait around for a personal profession of faith from every male child before he circumcised them, owing to the family solidarity assumed by the father's commitment, so Paul and Silas did not wait around for a personal profession of faith from the infants and the children before they baptized them, owing to the family solidarity assumed by the Philippian jailer. Jeremiah puts it this way. He says, the solidarity of the family in baptism and not the individual decision of the single member was the decisive consideration. When we consider family solidarity resting upon the authoritative influence of the head of the family, it is scarcely conceivable that the baptism of a household did not include all of its members. The possibility that children might not be baptized along with their parents was not contemplated at all, unquote. And so it is, fathers. The weight of responsibility rests upon your shoulders. When our culture and society, while it may consider family solidarity to be passé and so silly, God does not. You are still the federal head of your family in a covenant economy. And you have the responsibility to proclaim to your kids, this is the way, walk ye in it. And when you do that, you experience what the jailer and his family experienced. He rejoiced. He rejoiced along with his entire oikos, his household, that he had believed in God. So it was, so it is, so it ever will be, with God at least, with families everywhere, some of which appear here every Sabbath morning with their children and their infants, to hear the word of the Lord preached to them. The joy of the Lord can be your strength as well, Father, Son, Daughter. It is time to lead your family, not in some false, subjective way, where what is true for you may not be true for me, and you have your truth and I have my truth, and vice versa. But lead your family in the way of the gospel, true now, true then, true it ever will be. True for the Philippian jailer and his family, his oikos, and true for every family sitting here today, your oikos, including the Garcia family. Well, that brings us to point three. Unwritten, but still very much at point here today. We invite the Garcia family over up front here to be enfolded into New Geneva's membership here today.